It's the motherfucking Millennial Mija podcast.
Welcome to the first episode of the Millennial Mija podcast on the Good News Radio. Today is Father's Day, and I am here in the studio with two of my very good friends, Tor Crawford.
What up, what up?
And Jennifer Hercules.
Hello.
I'm also in the studio with good man Keith, who I want to say thank you to for inviting me to join the TGN Latinx. This is historical. He was making me extremely nervous right before we went live, trying to drop all of the weight of the historical significance of this moment, but it's really not that serious. So I'm really happy to be here, and this is my first live radio podcast, so let's see what happens. There's people in the chat. I'm happy you're here. Please contribute to the conversation however you want. So today is Father's Day, and I am playing some Night Owl by Tony Allen, because when I think of my dad, that's one of the songs that comes to mind. And so it's no coincidence that my first live radio podcast is on Father's Day. I think it's fitting, because to me, I was very scared. And the thing that my dad has taught me most is that fear is my medicine. And so here we go. So the thank yous, I have to get some thank yous out, because you know what? Recently, like, there have been so many people that have come into my life that have given just like the best energy and the best gift of their friendship. And Felicia, I have to say thank you, Felicia, because you have been here from day one helping me with this podcast. Dion, I have to shout out Dion, my baby boy, because if it wasn't for him, he came over to my house and helped me start this podcast. And Raquel, who helped me with some editing, like, just for free of charge, because she's a real one. And so there's a lot of real ones involved in this first episode, you know, because it took all the other episodes before this to get here. So first, I just want to say thank you to Jackie and Keith again for inviting me to come and be a part of the Good News Radio family. This is the first episode of any show on the TGN Latinx network. So we are, we're starting here. Here we are. We're here. So also I have to say thank you for my guests for coming, because I had no idea what I was going to talk about. Like, I had an idea, and then, you know, some things changed around. And then when that happens, I kind of just went crazy. And I'm like, well, what am I going to talk about now? You know, the panic sets in and the fear. And then I started thinking, you know what? I don't even want to do it anymore. I'm just going to tell them, never mind. Like, I don't want to do it. And it's all that fear that comes up, you know? And so the moment my friends agreed to come on the show, I felt so much better. I felt comfortable. I felt held. And I felt like I was going to be able to have a conversation that was worth sharing with the world. So thank you guys for being here. My next thank you is to every single person who has bought a crew neck from me on MillennialMija.com. I just released them on Friday. And so many of my friends have supported me by buying. And I love you so much. They're for all the Mija making moves out there. So if you are a Mija making moves, you definitely want to go to MillennialMija.com and get you a crew neck. Also, I have to say thank you to Ashley from Brown Girl Travels. She has been helping me with the Season of Self boxes that I have been putting together. And she is a little genius. You know, she's a little mastermind, and she helps me a lot. So those boxes are coming, and I just want to say thank you, Ashley. So I want to start my Father's Day episode by introducing my father. But to me, the best person who could do that would be the person who introduced him here. So I'm going to allow Emilio Rivera to introduce my dad, and this is the best way we can introduce him to the show.
This guy, he saved my life two times, man. 25 years ago when I OD'd, and he walked me around for 3 hours to keep me alive. And then he showed me he was a good homeboy then. And then May 15th, 18 years ago, he brought me to my first NA meeting. And that's the first time I got clean now, you know. And I was losing my mind, homie, and he knew I was, and he's part of familia. And I tried to take out mines. And he was there the next day, you know, picking me up to go to a meeting. And I wasn't ready for the meeting, man. And he goes, yeah, I know, but just call me. And then he was there every day, man, you know. And I look out the window, I said, fuck, he's out there, you know. And he was, yeah, man, you know. And he was like, I go, yeah, you know, I don't feel like going today. He goes, I don't even feel like going, but you got to go, so just go. And he brought me, man. And I got 18 years clean of that because of that, you know. This is Ernesto Aguirre from East LA.
So that's my dad. My dad was someone who I think the best way to describe him is the way that other people describe him. Just hearing the way other people talk about my dad when he gets brought up in a conversation or on Facebook or on Instagram, where people will find videos of him talking. And their tributes to him are special to me because they're a testament to the kind of person that he was. And my dad talked a lot. He was not perfect, but he talked a lot about recovery and staying clean. And in the recording that you just heard, that was Emilio talking about how my dad helped save his life. And not just literally physically, but, you know, when a person recovers from, chooses to recover from drugs, they're choosing to live. They're choosing life. And that's a big deal. And I wouldn't be here if it weren't for the choices of both my mother and my father to choose life and to choose recovery after addiction. So I thank you, Mommy. Thank you, Daddy. But so here we are talking about fathers on Father's Day, my father in particular. You know, the complexity of this day for all of us is crazy because it means something different to everyone. Depending on your experience with your own father, that's how you're going to feel about this day. And so when Jen and Tor agreed to say yes, you know, it's interesting because Tor was there with me the day I found my father on my birthday in 2011. And he was actually with me. And he and a few other my other friends, you know, took me to the hospital with my dad. And so it's very fitting that you're here. And it's also very fitting that you lost your father as well. Yeah. And so it's like a way for us to kind of like process. And then I have Jen, who has been my personal friend and therapist for the last however long we've known each other. Like, we became like this extremely fast, but, you know, it was meant to be. But she has her own relationship with her father that we're going to incorporate into the conversation, because the complexity is what I want to talk about. And I also want to create a space for processing and for grieving and for honoring our fathers in whatever way we feel comfortable doing. And so that's what this is going to be today. I wanted to share a few things about a few of my favorite things about my dad. I'm going to just like go rapid fire. So the way he told stories, he was always happy to see me. How he was always proud of me, how he listened to me when I talked. We always ate good and we always had fun. And when we would go cruising, those were some of my favorite memories, favorite memories. And what was funny about my dad was that my dad was broke his whole life. Like, that was just like part of his identity. He was just broke. And so he never had like a really nice car until like later on in life. But we would go cruising in his like bucket, but it was clean though. Like, it was, he kept it so clean. He really did. And the rim story, that's one I'm going to show, share a little bit later. But I wanted to incorporate you guys because I wanted to know, what is it about this day that, or actually, how do you feel about this day? Like, what is the general feeling of this day for you?
Ladies first.
So I'll start. For me, it's really tumultuous. I'm grateful for my brothers who are great fathers. My brothers who are really trying to break the cycles of unhealthy fatherhood stories.
Yeah.
And I also feel like, how do I avoid this day? How do I not really talk about it? Mm-hmm. And how do I support people who don't have a positive relationship with their father? Because I don't think I do, per se. I don't have a bad one, but it's not where I would want it to be in my healing journey.
Yeah.
But so it is kind of like an avoidant, let's kind of talk about it, but not talk about it and pretend like it's just another day.
Yeah, just get through it. Kind of like survival mode. Because that's been my experience with Father's Day, too. Like, the reason why I said yes to doing this show on Father's Day was because I'm sad every Father's Day. Like, I already know I'm going to be sad. So I would rather have something to do. And it made sense that what I had to do was a podcast, and what better way to, you know, utilize that time than, one, to bless this space with my dad's energy. We have some sage, we have pictures of him, and we have some of his warrior energy in the room, because that's something that I'm also learning from my dad through my spiritual energy cleanses, is my warrior energy. So instead of avoiding, like you're talking about, mm-hmm. like just walking straight towards the thing that scares you.
Yes.
Because, you know, growth is right there on the other side.
And that's where I'm at in my healing journey, is that I just have to be looking at it head on instead of dipping and dodging and running and drinking or whatever I used to do.
Numbing it. That
I don't do anymore. So now I'm like, okay, how do I have a positive reaction to this? So I appreciate you for creating this space, because I was dipping and dodging for 33 years and now we're hitting 34. And I'm like, okay, I think it's time that I face this head on. Mm, I appreciate you.
I love you too. Tor, what about you? What's your relationship with this day?
First off, shout out to all the homies.
Shout out.
Yeah.
Shout out to everybody out there who's a father and doing their part, no matter what it looks like. I think that's like a big thing. Like, it doesn't look the same, right? this morning, every Father's Day for me is like a day for me to hide. Mm-hmm. Like, the first thing I want to do is I want to like dig in my little hole and I want to isolate from everybody. I was telling her that before, you know, we left for the day. It's like a real weird, strong feeling that I can't grasp or describe. And that's me even working on everything with my dad.
Yeah.
You know, for me, my pops, everything that he gave me, game-wise, whatever it is in life, I couldn't put it to work until after his passing. Mm-hmm. As weird as that sounds, you know? So everything he's telling me to do and how I should be growing up as a Black man, you know, my dad was big in the church. And a lot of things that he would say, he didn't follow.
Uh-huh.
So when you're telling me something and my brain's processing it, my brain can't take it in because it's like, it's a lie. Straight up. That's just what it is. But for me to finally get to that point of understanding and just taking things for what it is, I have to work on that. Like, this is going to sound weird. I have to work with the spirit of just accepting things for what they were. We're taught throughout life, you know, what a father should be. These are the qualities. And if they're a bad father, they do this. They're a good father, they do this. Yo, everybody's journey is different. And for me to hold him on this pedestal of perfection, he's a person first who was taught a certain way.
Yeah.
And for the most part, he's teaching that to me.
Yeah.
So for me to grow through it, I have to break cycles. And what I saw that wasn't healthy for me.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at now in the journey of just accepting everything for what it is. You know, most people in life, they're just doing the best that they can to get by.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So for me to hold you at this unrealistic standard, I'm at fault for that. And I had to come at peace with myself to be like, yo, you have to let that go. And that's not just with my father, my mom, my friends, whatever. That's just people in general. Everybody's doing the best that they can to get by.
Yeah, you're right. The general feeling of this day, I think, is like, depending on the relationship that you have, but most of us in here, all of us, all three of us, avoided the day. Like you said, it was a day for you to hide. And me too. I avoid social media at all costs on Father's Day. Like, I just can't handle it. Like, I remember feeling like every little post was just like a little pain in my heart. Like, you know, just a reminder of what I'll never have again.
It's like people poking fun at you. Like, yeah. I still got my dad.
And when you're unhealed, or when that like relationship is unhealed, then it feels personal. Well, everything feels personal when you're unhealed in your journey, you know, but So I wanted to switch gears a little bit and I wanted to talk. So I said that one of my favorite things about my dad was the way that he told stories. And, you know, my dad was a funny guy. He was funny. And the way he explained things was, I don't know, it was unique. It was unique. My dad was a unique individual. And so I could say all of these things about him. Like, I could tell you that he was born in 1947 in L.A., in East L.A., proud of East L.A., never let you forget it. And, you know, they called him Crazy Ernie. And the reason why they called him that was because when he was 17 years old, he told me that on his 17th birthday, his stepdad bought him a brand new suit and a brand new car. And he took it to a party. And because he was known as Crazy Ernie, that meant he was never allowed to back down from a fight. So he came back. Someone volunteered him to, like, settle something for his friends. And I guess he came back, and the windows were busted in on the car, and the suit had blood all over it. And so he would tell me these stories, and it was always in humor, but he always had a message, you know? And so that's something that I want to share with you now. So let me see. Let me go back to where I wanted to go. Because, yeah, the thing, my dad, you know, like I said, he was a unique individual, and the way he explained things was unique. So let's hear from him. 2:55. I should have had this queued up, but, you know, I didn't. No dead air. No dead air. Say something, guys. We can't have dead air on this. Come on.
Shout out to all the dads who are filling in roles that are just hard to fill in. So uncles. I know my uncles did a lot for me on Father's Day. My brothers, my cousins, ninos.
Yeah, they everybody. All feel. It's because it looks a different way. Every, you know, any father relationship. Because a father is not always the person you share blood with, you know?
Right.
I mean, that can be anyone. It's really about filling that role. All right, so this is a object lesson story that my dad tells about a mayonnaise jar.
And they had this mayonnaise jar, those big mayonnaise jars. It was empty and it was full of mud, and it had a little thing, turned it around, and it says, "My name is Ernesto, and I'm holding my mud." And that was a object lesson, right? So I'm walking around with this goddamn thing. You know, and I'm pretty intelligent, man. I ain't that dumb. How long do you think I carried that thing around? All I had to do was come back to the office and say, "My name is Ernesto, and I don't want to hold my mud anymore." Fuck you. I'll be damned before I say something like that. That pride and all that shit, Aztec warrior and all that bullshit, you know. I was just an afraid little boy, man, you know. And that's what I've learned in Narcotics Anonymous. That I've just been scared all this time. You know, that child they talk about, man, I used to put him in the back. I tell him, I'll take care of it, man. That's how I got all these scars. See, every scar I got, it hurt like a motherfucker. Don't tell nobody. You guys will fuck up my image. So finally, I turned that thing in after like 35 days. But I learned something from that. I learned, man, that it's okay to put the mud down, man. And that's why, you know.
So my dad talked a lot about the mud. So if you don't know the reference, because like I said, my dad was born in 1947. So some of his references are a little outdated. But when he talks about holding your mud, it's like about how men are not allowed to let out any of their emotions. So the object lesson that he tells this story about holding this mayonnaise jar around and kind of, you know, refusing to turn it in because his masculinity or his machismo or whatever you want to call it wouldn't allow him to do that. And, you know, nobody could tell me that when my dad is talking, he's not teaching, you know. That's what he does. And that was one thing that I really loved about him. It was the way he told stories because they always had a message, but they're always entertaining, you know. Whenever he got to his point eventually, you know, he took a few twists and turns, but he would get there eventually. And when he did, you would feel good about yourself. And that's what I always remember about him. You know, like hearing my dad talk like that about, you know, the afraid little boy, like, did that bring up anything? Like, what did you, as a man in this conversation? Because we talked about that before.
That ego, like you care, that's not the ego, but that child that you carry is always. If you don't get it in check and you don't grow and understand feelings and accepting them for what they are, that child is always going to respond for you as an adult.
Yeah.
That first traumatic experience that led to whatever it is always, you just revert right back to it. Scream, like whether you scream, you hit, you, however you react, you know? And I know for me, that was a big one. Because I would ask myself, yo, why are you still, like, acting like this?
Mm-hmm. You know, acting from your wound.
Yeah, acting from my wounds, and I'm acting from a place of hurt that's, like, 20-something years ago. Like, I'm still holding that?
Yeah. Like, and that's how he would teach those lessons. Like, you know, the lessons that you're talking about, like, he told them through stories, because he never said any of those words that you just said,
right.
But he said all of those words.
Right, right.
You know, and that was the thing when I say he has a unique voice. You know, it's like, because he never went to the type of therapy that you and I talk about, right. You know, like the talk therapy with a therapist, but he went to meetings. And he went to these kind of like indigenous ceremonies and like a brotherhood he was in. And so he had his own, everything he did it from his own way,
right.
You know, and same with my mom. But, you know, my dad, this is Father's Day episode. So, you know, some of the other things that I love about him was how he would brag about me, and he would always brag about my poems. He would literally print out my poems and hand them to people, like he would. And, the first place I ever got published as a writer was in a prison newsletter, because my dad put my poem Crazy Ernie about him. He put it in there in the prison newsletter.
That's right.
I remember driving around the East Side, like that's what my dad calls it, the East Side, and that's East LA. And for every corner, every hamburger place, every tacos, there's a story for everything. And there's a memory. And so I still have those memories when I drive around. And so it's still a way for me to keep him alive. You know, like sometimes when I feel sad or when I feel like I don't, you know, like you just miss someone, and there's still places that I can go. But a lot of those places are being gentrified very quickly. So it's really difficult because, you know, there are spaces, you know, gentrification doesn't just like erase neighborhoods or like, you know, push people out. It does that. But it also like steals people's physical memories.
Your history.
Yeah. It's erasing them from history. Like, because some of us, our memories are all we have left.
Right.
Like, there are certain places in Highland Park or in Lincoln Heights that I can still go to this day and sit and just, like, be as close as I possibly can to, you know, feeling close to my dad. And, man, the way things are going, it seems like a lot of those places are not going to be left. It's like, it's hard to watch. Something else I loved about him was that he always told me the truth. Always told me the truth. In a loving way, but I remember always, like, being able to, you know, confide in him. He always knew the best places to eat. I always said that. I already said that. But, you know, he was just a person that brought life into every room that he entered. And a person that, like I said, was a unique individual. And what about you? What do you think? What do you think about father-daughter relationships specifically? Like, because, you know, there's a father dynamic that they have with a son that a father-daughter dynamic doesn't have. Like, what is your experience with that, and what do you think about it?
My dad was definitely he loved his daughters, and he definitely treated us differently. I can say that, like, just from childhood memories, like we are his princesses. We're like the geniuses. He also always, oh wow, they're so smart, they're geniuses.
Yeah.
And he always just, I don't know, he loved us in a very like deep way, and I appreciate that. I can't like knock him for that. And I think it's just a whole different dynamic. I see my brothers, they have daughters. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful to watch. And I did get that love when I was little, and I can't deny that.
Yeah.
And hearing you talk about it reminds me of that.
Yeah. Because
there's some things that were like, oh, you know, I'm still hung up on whatever other things he did. But in all honesty, like those are some moments. Like, he would always take me, and he never really like said, oh, you're a girl, you can't do this. He never was really, mm-hmm. like, machista in that way, per mm-hmm. se, directly. But he would take me cruising. That was the one thing we had to, and that makes sense as to why we're friends and we like cruising together.
Yeah.
But
definitely. He
would always take me cruising. My dad always had the newest whips. He loved fixing cars. Like, that was something that he taught me. And so I probably know more about cars than other men, like,
yeah,
because he would teach me. We'd go to the mechanics. We knew where all the junkyards were because we knew how to fix it. Like, he was just like, this is what we're doing, mm-hmm. and you're gonna help me out.
Yeah,
and
because it wasn't like treating you different because you were a girl.
No,
mine was like that too. It was like, he was, because I was a girl, my dad only had daughters. So wow. He was like a girl dad five times. Like he had a lot of kids. Wow. And, you know, I have four kids. And it is like, I don't know how to explain it. When we were talking about the dynamic, like father-daughter specifically, like I remember my dad was really about empowering me, like as a woman. So he would show me things. He would expose me to like Dolores Huerta or like stories about like famous Chicanas that are like strong or like, you know, role models like that. I remember, you know, he was always about making sure that we talked about like equality, you know, like in that way, like we would talk a lot about that. Like it's equal, you know, men and women, you know, politics and all that. But it was never like in the words that we're saying, you know, yeah. He always had his different way of getting to it. What about you, Tor? Father, son. Dynamic.
You know, we, again, like me and my pops never had the greatest relationship. Yeah. I was always on like kind of like the run to not be around him just because, you know, the verbal abuse was a lot. You know what I'm saying? If you're constantly being tormented by somebody, it's one thing to get tormented at school. But if you're getting tormented at home,
that's a different level of heavy.
You don't really have nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's like a big thing of why like me, Jose and everybody, we became so close because, like, I felt shelter at their house. You know what I'm saying?
That's real.
So, again, like, it comes back to, like, all the stuff that my dad was trying to teach me. Like, there was a lot of good. And, like, the things he was telling me or the things he was showing me or telling me, trying to guide me to avoid. But the way it was given to me, I just didn't want it. Mm-hmm. If you have beaten me down so much emotionally and physically, I can't trust you. I can't take it.
Yeah.
Like, you can give me all the game in the world. I can't take it. I can't.
Yeah. Because there's too much pain there. There's too much pain in between being able to receive the love. Because when there's pain and anger and all that stuff, like, you can't get to the love.
Right.
You know, you can't let yourself feel it because you have so much anger and resentment. And that's the thing that all three of us have in common is that we're working on that now. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we're all in our season of self. So, for the people who are new to me or anything that I do, I have a season of self workshop that is all about self healing. And, you know, both Heather, she's not here. Jen took my workshop and she came on my retreat. And Tor has been on my podcast and he has been also on his own healing journey. But that's something we all three have in common is that we are committed to doing the work. And when I say the work, I mean the crying, the processing, but also the letting go, you know, like also the like moving on after you've done processing the trauma so that you don't carry it around like what we're talking about, you know, that is the gift that we can give to ourselves, that even whether or not our fathers knew how much they messed us up or helped us, whatever, either one, you know, that we got life and then we got to choose what we do with it.
We got to put down that mud.
Yeah. Put the mud down. So, okay, I have another story. So when I was 21, I had a silver Toyota Corolla, and my dad insisted that it needed rims and tinted windows. So he took me to Rent-A-Wheel in El Monte, where we got there, and he told me I could pick anyone that I wanted from this big wall. There was every kind of rim you could think of. I immediately went for the sparkly gold spoke rims because they were shiny and glittery. He said I had a good taste, but he said putting rims on your car is like buying jewelry. Every car has a personality. You can't just pick any rims and put them on your car. You have to pick the right ones for your car. So my dad suggested the exact same rims he had on his car, an Audi, 20-inch black rims with a chrome lip on low-profile tires. Simple but clean, he said. Classic. I'll never forget the feeling of standing outside Rent-A-Wheel looking at our cars parked in the parking lot right next to each other. And he put his arm around me and he said, look, mija, like father, like daughter. They were perfect. So that is a little excerpt from The Courage to Change, which is a screenplay that I've been working on little by little, inch by inch. A screenplay that I've been working about my relationship with my dad and I want him to live forever. And as long as I live and as long as I'm allowed to talk about him, I'm going to talk about him and help him live. But I also want something to outlive me. So that's why I want to tell the story, because to me, he's an unlikely hero. You know, like people like my mom and my dad are people who society threw away, addicts, heroin addicts, the bottom of the bottom, you know, and people don't realize that my dad never left East L.A., but he made a big difference in the world, like in the world. And, you know, like because those small victories of people deciding to get clean, that's saving a life. That's giving someone a second chance, you know. And so that's what he always talked about, was talking about recovery and talking about, you know, having the courage to change. I want to play some music too, but you know, anyways, I feel like I have too many, like being in the studio, you guys, is so scary and weird. Like there's so many operating moving parts. Let me show you. We have like all this high tech stuff. Whoa. Look at Keith.
Hey.
It's so many things to figure out. Look, we have screens up here. High tech.
It's your show. High tech.
I know. We will.
I'm loving the story.
The stories is what, you know, this is how my dad lives, and he's going to continue living that way. We have so here's another one, Nightingale. No,
I want to. In the chat, by the way,
oh, let's see what's up in the chat. Will you talk to the people in the chat right now real quick?
That was me. Bueno, alo.
Jen. Who else?
Jen, Michael, the PG-3.
Welcome to the squad. What's up, Michael?
Pan Dulce Papi's in there, too.
Pan Dulce Papi? I need to know who that is. Please tell us your name. Oh, no. Uh-oh. Secret admirer time. No, dude. So how me and Jackie met is on Clubhouse. Yeah. We met on Clubhouse, and she watched my podcast and on Instagram, and she reached out to me and was like, have you ever thought about doing live radio? And I was like, I've never thought about that, not even once.
You better do it.
So then I'm like, let me go see what she's talking about. So I go to the meeting, and then I'm like, you know, that's something that I didn't get to bring up because I was all nervous in the beginning. You guys are also fucking nervous. I'm still nervous right now, but I'm like 50% less nervous because we're almost 50% done with this. So
good way to look at it.
So what I was trying to say is I forgot.
Oh,
so yes. So she asked me, you know, should I, you know, do I want to do live radio? So I had to think about it like for a whole week, and I thought about it, and I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna say no because I'm scared. Like, I don't know how I'm gonna be at this, and I don't usually say yes. I feel like I have, for a long time, I didn't say yes to things if I didn't know I could deliver a perfect result, you know, because I was like, I just have no confidence. And so, and that cycle continued because I kept saying no to things that were hard and scary. And so because I know that I don't belong in that carcacha out there, I belong in a Tesla. So until I get there, the only way I'm going to get there is by continuing to walk towards fear so that I can walk towards growth, so that I can do things that scare me because that's my medicine. And so that is also something that I have learned from my dad in my energy cleanses. Like, so I do these energy cleanses where it's basically like a meditation. Shout out to Jennifer Escalera. She has been there with me through this whole journey and given me a gift of being able to help me connect even just energetically with my dad to kind of like receive lessons still to this day that I'm still learning from him. But these energy cleanses are like a meditation. And it's like you're going into like another experience, like another spiritual realm or something, you know? And it's crazy the way it feels like when it's happening because it's intense. Like I can feel, almost smell my dad. Like, you know, because there's when you do this like healing stuff, you get all introduced to like the crystals and the sage and all of the indigenous like healing medicines. And all of those things really are tools. And they make all those experiences more like potent, right? What have been your experiences with the energy cleanses?
It's amazing. It's amazing because of the amount of creativity and really tapping into your subconscious mind. I'm a super logical person. I need to go to school to get this very rigid like A plus B equals C, and to have an experience with Mystic School. Shout out Jennifer, to have that experience with someone who's both licensed. She's a licensed clinician, LCSW, and she's also she's a healer.
Yeah.
A holistic healer. And that has been just great to tap into my creative side and really tap into new, like you said, meditations and subconscious energies that I didn't know could be possible. And so it's opened up a whole new world for me.
Yeah, the energy cleanses are like an additional form of healing, you know? Like all this like also this talking is also a form of therapy. That's the podcast started. I didn't do so many things I said I was going to do. I was going to get on here and like have like a whole outline, bitch. I got on here and just started talking. I didn't say none of the things I was going to say. But
let it flow.
Here we are. So now that we're 30 minutes into the podcast, let me tell you about who I am. The podcast started as a way to heal myself through real ass conversation. Like that's my goal with the podcast. And I realized that as I was having these conversations with people, that they were incredibly powerful and not just me could benefit from them. And so the podcast was born. Like I said, thanks again to Dion for, you know, coming through and literally sitting with me because I was having a hard time. Like, you know, when you make excuses and every reason is a reason why you can't do something you want to do. But the real reason is because you don't believe in yourself. Because when you start to believe in self and you force yourself, you kind of start to see that any excuse you could come up with, you could also come up with a solution to that excuse.
Hello.
Hello. Nobody wants to talk about that, though.
Not today.
Dude, so I did want to play music, but, like, I want to talk a little bit about the soundtrack to our childhoods because, you know, I want to shout out my mom and my dad for giving me a fire-ass soundtrack to my life. You know, like, I feel like that really set me up for success in, like, a lot of ways because I feel like my relationship with music is like also a form of healing for me. What kind of music did your dad introduce you to growing up?
Man, so I just came back from, I'm gonna call it a retreat with my Hercules side of the family, which is my father's side of the family. And me and my cousins the whole time for like 3 days straight, we're just singing songs off the top of our heads from childhood the whole time. And it was like a ping pong between the three of us singing songs, and it was like cumbia, merengue. We were singing Sasa Sapo, which is from like our childhood, like little childhood rhymes that you used to dance to, like, because we were the type of family who would dance until 3 a.m. We were 7, 8, 9, no restrictions, everybody just running around, like, just dancing. And so it was always cumbia, merengue, salsa, freestyle,
yeah.
80s. So it was all of that. It's something that I think we continue to love, and it's what brings us together as a family.
Yeah,
is music.
Definitely.
Because anybody will start dancing at any moment for no reason, just screaming out lyrics for no reason, and that's something that our parents did give us, you know, and I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. I would say oldies is like, you know, the soundtrack, the background to my life, you know? Like, here's some Suavecito from Malo. Like, all them Chicano cruising oldies, that was my childhood, you know? But also, everything from the Eagles to Jimi Hendrix.
Yes.
To, like, you know, like I said, my dad was born in 1947. So, you know, he'd been around, you know? So he had access to a lot of different forms of music, and that was something that, you know, we talked about cruising. What about you, yes. Tor? What is some music that you were introduced to from your dad, and how did that affect you later?
A lot of Al Green. Al Green, Bob Marley, Sade, like, all that stuff. My pops was always on it, and then he was always playing jazz. Like, anytime you got in the car, and one thing I always did give him props for is that he would try to cater to what I like, too. He was just really weird with, you know, rappers saying the N-word. He was just, like, really, it, like, weirded him out.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, like, Corrupt, Pac, he would listen to Biggie, anything. That was like the one thing that he would actually like be like, all right, well, put me on game for this, because he's like, yo, you know, it's evolving, and you like your own thing. You're gonna be riding in the car with me. You know, we might as well enjoy music together.
That's dope.
He put me up on a lot of music and a lot of genres. I'm extremely grateful for that. And you know, that's like a big memory. Like when we would be coming back from my aunt's house in Long Beach, he would always have the radio on 88.1 K-Jazz. So to this day, that gets played in the house. So, you know, I'm extremely grateful for his excellent musical choice.
Yeah.
And handing it down to me.
So when I think of my dad, I think of music too. Like that whole part of my life, like growing up, the cruising and all that, like it's so full of music, but also mariachi too. Mariachi and, you know, like merengue too. And like just, you know, my dad was funny because I remember this one time we were driving and he would always play the music really loud, like really loud with all the windows down. And he was always like in his own, he was vibing, like jamming just like all the time. And so this lady was in the side car next to us and she's just like smiling. And then my dad gets out of the car and goes to his trunk and gets the CD and goes and gives it to her. And he was like, here, he's like, you can be like me. So he gives her the CD. And that's always something that I remember because he used to like to, I don't know, give. He was just a giver. He was for somebody that was very giving. So, yeah. So, like I said, he was born in 47 in L.A., but more specifically East L.A., even more specifically Lincoln Heights. Because just the same way like New York is, like East LA has little boroughs, you know? And so Lincoln Heights is where he would go. And so he would always tell me that everywhere I go, I take East LA with me. And that was something that always stuck with me because he was very proud of where he was from. Where was your dad from, Tor?
Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And he brought that with him to Los Angeles, California. You know, he's very proud of his southern roots. And he always would put me up on game about how different LA is from the South and how, how would I say it? I was privileged to be growing up black in LA because it's a lot different in the South. And, you know, those horror stories about hearing about Jim Crow and all that in that era, you know. So,
how old was he around that time?
My pops was born in 49.
We had some old-ass parents.
And my dad had me when he was, 47, I think?
Okay.
Damn, my pops was, yeah. I was the last one out of the batch. But yeah, you know, growing up, you know, in his teenage years with that, like, it's crazy. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, to this day, like, ain't much shit changed.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Where was your dad from originally?
My dad's a Salvadorian, so I'm half Salvadorian, half Mexican. And he came over here as a young, like maybe 18, 19. Oh, we popped it off with the sage.
Wow, the sage. Oh, you lit it again. That's why. Okay. So maybe put it outside. You put the sage outside. I do. That happens to me all the time. My mom is always like, the sage! Because the damn, like, thing goes off all the time. Anyways, go on. So, he's Salvadorian?
Yeah, he's Salvadorian. But most Salvadorians out here in L.A. know that the first place we go to is Pico Union Westlake. So, over by MacArthur Park, that's where my family kind of moved to. And that's where they worked. That's where they grew up. So shout out Westlake, Pico Union. That's where all the Salvadorian Hondureños, Nicaragüense, everybody was there. So that was our home away from home. MacArthur Park was, and Echo Park were the two parks that we used to play at. Mm. And my dad was super proud. We went to the Salvadorian Bank on Vermont, El Banco Salvadoreño. We were getting nonces in front of.
What about when you took me to your neighborhood and she was like, let me show you where I used to buy shoes. Tell me why we passed by this door of the man sitting outside of a door, right?
Beverly
but you
Boulevard.
Look inside the door, and it's just shoes. Like, it was like, I can't explain. It was a mountain of shoes, like, not in boxes.
You can't even see
just
inside. Sock,
just damn shoes all right there. And she was like, ask him, what any shoe you want? He probably has it. I was like, I don't know. She was like, it was a mountain of shoes, dude.
Anybody from L.A.? Knows that that's on Beverly Boulevard in front of the car wash.
I didn't even know about that one, not the mountain
of
shoes.
In front of the panaderia. That's where you go get the shoes and all the goodies before school. But yeah, he was super proud. He bought me all Spanish books. Like, look, you're going to learn Spanish. I don't care how or what you need to do, because they were cutting bilingual funding in that moment, like in the 90s. So he was like, well, we're going to buy books and you're just going to read this every night. And you're going to listen to, we would watch some bootleg, like, TV, like, some Salvadorian TV thing where they would have, like, a little spot in the cut off of Temple and, like, Alvarado.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, what are we doing here? He was like, this is what you need to learn. You need to learn, like, your country is beautiful. And they would do, like, I guess it was kind of like Channel 28.
like PBS, like you know how they do, like we're going on this excursion to go see like the new Mexican chilies. They have that, but in El Salvador, and they're like, these are the toucans. Look at how. So we would watch everything related to El Salvador. We were watching it. Salvadoran music always on. So
proud. Yeah.
Yeah. Super proud.
Yeah. The you know, growing up in being from LA, my dad, I remember he had the Dodgers. The Dodgers was like a thing because he had like a torn relationship with the Dodgers because of Chavez Ravine. So growing up, my dad was never really a Dodger fan like that, mostly because he knew his history. He was always telling me stories about the different neighborhoods in LA. Dodger Stadium was built on top of an existing Mexican community. The three neighborhoods in Chavez Ravine were called La Loma, Palo Verde, and Bishop. At first, the plan was to build low-income housing projects, but later the plans for Dodger Stadium were introduced. That meant that the developers of the city of LA tried to repossess the land owned by these families, basically the beginning of gentrification, and you know, they offered them tiny amounts of money for their homes. And so some of the people sold their homes willingly, but so many people didn't, you know. And so my dad would always talk about the Battle of Chavez Ravine because the last residents that were occupying it, like, they had to physically remove them because they were so proud. They weren't going to give them, you know, the land. And so my dad told me to always understand the history of things that you support, you know. So it was always like, damn, I can't like the Dodgers. Like, you know, he still wore the jersey and all that stuff, but it was just kind of like he was the kind of dad that that made sure I knew details about my history, and that is something that always sticks out to me. So he told me to always understand that, you know. And so he compared it to my favorite Disney at the time, Pocahontas. I remember he was telling me, he's like, you remember how those white people came to her native land and they try to claim it as their own? He said, that's the same thing they did to our people. Like, they have been trying to erase us for centuries, but they can't. And that's when he taught me about that saying, like, they tried to erase us, but they didn't know we were seeds. And that is a Mexican, like, dicho, you know, like, that actually comes from our people. And he said, you know, that means they can try all they want, but our people will not be erased, you know. This is our land, and one day it will be ours again. And so that's the way he would talk. You know, he always had, like I said, a lesson, but through stories. So do you remember, Tor, a story that you can tell us about your dad? Maybe, like, anything about your dad's childhood. Like, what was his childhood like?
I'll be honest with you. I don't know much of it. Mm-hmm. Like, me and my dad were so, it's real weird. You know what I'm saying? Like, him growing up, like me growing up, like, our household was, my mom and dad are there, but they're not there, if that makes sense. You know what I'm saying? Like, they don't sleep in the same room. He's not around until after a certain hour. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? So, mm-hmm. again, like, that goes back to, like, me finding salvage to go into Jose's house or going to someone else's house. Like,
yeah, growing up in other people's houses.
Right. And that's, like, I grew up in Jose's culture almost. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like I know more about Spanish culture than black culture.
Yeah.
And that's fucked up for me to say. Like, I feel bad saying that.
Because you're tied to black culture, but you didn't have a tie to that person. So that's also true. That happens because, like, when my dad died, I felt like a whole arm of my identity died, you know, like, because I lost touch with a lot of people on that side of my family. And so, like, when you don't have the relationship with that person anymore, it's like you said, it's your access to that part of your culture.
And I don't even really have, like, much of a relationship with any of that side of that family. Mm. I don't have a relationship with my sister. You know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of that stuff is, and that's on me too, not reaching out. But there are times where I just feel, like, ashamed that I don't really know who I am or I don't know what I came from. And, that's something that I still work on to this day, because all these things, that's why a lot of the times when I see stuff that goes on in the community, I automatically feel like, oh, I'm not even a part of it.
Mm.
And that, again, that child comes back who's hurt. Like, yo, I was never taught this. I was never introduced to this. Like, I don't feel a part.
Like, left out.
Like, who do I ask? You know, mm-hmm. like a kid. Like, who do I ask?
Who do you ask? Who do you ask?
Or feeling embarrassed to tell somebody that. Like, I'm about to be 34 years old, and there's a lot of stuff in black culture I cannot tell you about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I carry that I am ashamed of, but I'm getting through with it, you know, because as much as I feel like people don't understand, there's tons of people who can feel that and understand that, and there's also tons of people who are willing to help me and guide me.
Yeah, that's real.
But I wanted it from my dad, but I couldn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still that resentment and anger because I didn't get it from him. You know, like, you want your pops to teach you about everything. Put you up on game on sports, females, jobs, where to go to school. Like, I wanted to be guided to go to HBCU, but I never got that. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wanted to learn about fixing cars and all that stuff. I never got that.
Mm.
So, for me, like, a lot of those stories and those things, I just don't have them, you know?
That's real. And that's real, because when we talk, like, oh, Father's Day, everything is always so blanket general.
Right.
Like, oh, tell me, like, even me asking the question, like, oh, tell me about your Dutch childhood. And the question is, like, damn, the fact that you don't have the answer is the painful part.
And then hearing these stories and how detailed and vivid they are, right? And then yeah. It makes us feel like, damn, I gotta fall back. Like the Homer Simpson gif when he's like falling in the trees, like, it automatically makes me just want to be like,
yeah,
all right, let me just kind of sit in the back, because mm-hmm. It makes me feel not as important.
You can't contribute that,
right? And then it makes me go back to feeling like, oh, people they're not gonna be interested, or they don't care, you know. And that's where, again, like, going back to the start of the day, makes me want to hide and just be in my little ball.
Yeah.
But the comfort is being able to share that. Like, I haven't shared that with a lot of people, you know. Like, I just don't give the space to be asked that. Mm-hmm. Like, if I move a certain way, or if I'm not in these certain areas and stuff, nobody can ask me. Like, you can't know something about me if I don't allow it. And yeah. That's, I'm in control of that. But, like, if I sit here and it's like, okay, time for you to tell a story, I don't have a story.
Yeah.
You know, so.
That's what I think part of the healing aspect of this specific episode is that, like, talking about the complexity of people's relationships with their dads, you know, and how we have all these different types of feelings, even just at this table. We have such a different relationship with this day. And for whoever's listening, I want you to know that, you know, whatever relationship, whatever feeling you have today is valid. Very. It's valid, and you're not alone, because there's, it's not just, you know, when you see a Sears commercial and it's like Father's Day, you know, yeah. Like, it's like they just think that everyone has this, like, father to go and buy a tie for, like, you know, they just, like, don't give any dimension to the complexity of a father figure, you know. We don't get that. So I'm gonna share another story from my what is this called, screenplay. So this one is called Serenity Prayer. The day I signed the paper to take my dad off life support, there were 20 people in the room surrounding his bed in the ICU, and even more in the waiting room and lobby. At one point, the charge nurse came in and said we had to ask some people to leave because it was becoming a fire hazard. Imagine having so many people who love you, only a fraction of them causes a fire hazard. I looked around the room and told everyone we were going to say the Serenity Prayer together. I told the nurse to let him go as we said amen. It was the first prayer I ever learned. My dad used to say it was the only one I would ever need. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. They used to say this prayer at the end of every NA meeting. The prayer was said in unison, like a chant in a strong whisper. In the candlelight meetings, they would stand in a circle and hold hands with their heads bowed. I always used to imagine it was a spell for some reason. All these years later, I know it is. It is a beautiful surrender, saying to the Creator humbly, I trust you to guide me. And this breathing machine stopped after we said the prayer. He was gone. The pain was so intense, I fell to the floor. I don't remember much after that. I fell into a fog that would last a decade. And so when I talk about the fog, I talk about self-medicating with alcohol and relationships and a lot of Adderall and whatever, anything other than just dealing with it. So, you know, losing my dad is also something you can relate to me on. You know, like, maybe not the same feelings towards it, but that cutting off of a limb, almost, of a part of your identity, you know, like, there's something really profoundly painful about that. And there was for me, but what it brings up is how you deal with pain, you know? And neither of us had the most healthy coping skills. So talk to me about losing your dad, Tor. What was that like for you, given the complexity of your relationship with him?
I watched my dad deteriorate. So the doctor gave the timeline and everything, so we knew it was coming. So you try to prepare for it. And me thinking, you know, I'm like, yo, like, I'm not really connected to this person. It's not going to hurt like that. Nobody can tell anyone about feelings of death.
Yeah.
When it hits, everything's out the window. There's mm-hmm. there is no, like, yeah, you know, do this, or, you know, you're going to feel like that. Everybody has to, everybody got it different. You know what I'm saying? And as soon as he was gone, anything that surrounded our relationship, it goes with him. It's gone with him.
Yeah.
But I'm still alive, so I'm stuck with it. Except now I cannot have any conversations with this person. There's a whole lot of what ifs. Maybe only if
loose
I had
ends.
A yeah. lot of loose ends that you never get to, you know what I'm saying?
That you and have to find a way to, you know, make peace with yourself.
And, you know, as soon as I left the hospital, like when I got home, I drank. Once his funeral was done, I drank. And I carried that drink in. So he passed away in 2013. That lasted until last year of just bad habits over and over and over. And I'm very conscious of it. I'm conscious of everything I'm doing. Like, I'm asking myself, yo, why are you still drinking? Like, this is not right. Like, yo, you have night sweats. You, mm-hmm. this is not healthy. You can drink a whole bottle and still be standing and not black out.
That's not
there's,
normal.
There's nothing normal about that, and that's nothing to brag about. Mm-hmm. I thought it was something to brag about. Like, it's like something that makes me a man. It makes me be able to stand firm. Like, I can drink a full bottle of Hennessy. You can't fuck with me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, that's why, you know, like when I talked to Jennifer about it, like, you can still figure it out. He's still here. I talk to anybody who has it. Like, most of my friends, they got bad relationships with their dads, you know? You still have that opportunity. Opportunity is still there. When opportunity is gone, it's gone.
Yeah, it's a, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's like such
it's
a
so final.
Mm-hmm. It's such a cliche saying. When they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you hear that. But when you have to feel that, mm-hmm. it's a lot different.
Especially when you don't like to feel anything anyway.
Right. And you can't prepare for it. There's no ritual. There's no prayer. There's no friendship. No bottle. No weed, cocaine, pills, anything like that. That's going to get you through it.
That's true.
Nothing. All it's going to do is
numb you,
and it's going to give you this false sense of happiness that you start relying on, that if you're not messing with it, you can't get it.
Yeah.
You're just tricking yourself out of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had to, all everything that I'm healing with my dad is through myself now. So the one thing that still bothers me is that the perception of it, it's how I'm healing. It's just only my perception. Like, I can't fully tell, like, yo, would he have been open to this? How would he reacted to this? You know? So it's kind of like, that's where there's still like this weird feeling, you know, but that's what I'm left with. That's it.
Yeah.
There is no second chance. There is no coming back.
How do you make peace with that? How are you working on making peace with it? Or are you?
How I made peace with it, I was, you know, going to therapy and dealing with the actual trauma of it, is sharing that. Sharing the experiences and the mm-hmm. feelings with people and actually feeling things.
Especially as a man.
There's
because
times,
we could be saying the exact same thing right now and not be affecting the same people.
Right, right. There's times when I'll randomly, like, outburst cry with her and she's holding me. And it's like, it's almost like she can feel what it's coming from, but she doesn't really know. But it's just like, yo, this is my grieving is still coming out. It's like it's still got to leak out, and I'm okay with that. I used to hide it. Like, I was scared to cry because yeah. I felt it took away my manly qualities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was so fixated on that of the whole, like, keep your chin up, like, get pushed through it. No, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And actually being open to going to therapy and healing through it and finding healthy healing habits instead of drinking or going out and doing these things that I could fixate my mind on that aren't hurting me.
And the album that you're working on or that you just finished, that was a form of therapy, right?
Yeah. PTSD, pushing through shit daily, that I had to start sharing those traumas with people.
Yeah.
Of Because everybody used to be like, yo, he just turned up. He just be on his. It's like, yo, but there's a whole story behind why. Like, there's pain. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's always turned, there's just pain. Like, just drinking in general is pain. Who really likes to drink? Like, alcohol is not that tasty.
No, you're literally poisoning yourself. Like, that's what a hangover is. Because you poisoned yourself.
It's like, yo, like, yeah, like, out of all the things I'm going to pick up to drink, this, oh, yeah, it tastes like shit. That's why we be like, you know?
Yeah.
And being truthful about it, of being truthful, of not being scared anymore to share, like, the traumas I've been through, to of personal things of, like, you know, like, the whole, like, the robbery situation or situations with my dad or friends or, you know, past relationships with a potential child that might have been there, you know what I'm saying? And me sharing those things is, like, she gets brung into it, too. You know what I'm saying? So having my partner help me heal. You know what I'm saying? So to put that album out, I had such a false sense of security in myself of what I thought an artist was. I thought that if you follow these guidelines and you make this type of music and you look this certain way, like, yo, it's foolproof. Mm-hmm. There is no failure to it. And that was exactly what led me to failure, because I thought I had it.
Yeah, but the thought whole, I had figured it out.
But the whole time I had this whole story that was sitting right there. That's the gold mine.
Yeah.
That's the gold that people are looking
for. The courage to be vulnerable, the courage to tell the truth about yourself, the courage to be yourself. And in a world that's constantly telling you not to, because they, you know, are trying to sell us something. And that's the fear, that's also the fear of, you know, self-doubt. All of those things are the same thing. Like, they all come from the same energy of trying to hold you back from your greatness.
Right. And again, all the cliches, you know, it's, why would you want to sound like anybody else, look like anybody else, or be in this grouping of anybody? Like, yo, I stand firm who I am. Torbjorn Crawford, that is who I am. And there is no other before that or after that.
Yeah.
This is who I am. This is my story I need to share. I don't need to be ashamed of the things that have happened to me or the bad choices I've made. There's more people like me than not.
Mm-hmm.
That's why so many people fall to addiction, or so many people fall to these things, because they're trying to hide it. And there's, again, we're stuck in this world of perfection. There is no such thing as perfect. You're not getting there. I don't strive to be that. And I don't ever want to try to tell somebody you should be going for that, because it's just not real.
Yeah. Knowing who you are is, like, the real bag. That's really, like, how it.
Flaws and all. Mm-hmm. Take me as I am, as I come. Like, I'm not
self-acceptance.
I'm not going to sit here and try to. I pretended so much in my life. I can't do it no more.
Yeah. The courage that it takes to be yourself and knowing who you are, that's what this podcast is all about. And that's what this episode was about, because it was about, you know, knowing who you are means knowing where you came from. And knowing where you came from means you have to address the relationship that you have with your parents, because you literally came from them. So this was a space to kind of for me to process, but also for us to just openly talk about, you know, not, we don't have the best relationship with our dads. And it might sound like my dad is my hero, because he is, but it's easy to talk about someone like that when they're not here anymore, because you have romanticized your relationship with them, you know. And so I'm highly aware that my dad was not perfect, but there are so many things I love about him, and those are the things I wanted to focus on today, because there's a lot of pain and stuff like that that still happens behind the scenes. Because I was angry that he died. I was like, really? Like, you really? You're just gonna die like that? And, you know, there's still anger and stuff there, but today I wanted to talk about some of the things that I liked. And I'm really thankful that you guys were here with me to do it, because I was nervous. And like, we talked a lot about fear earlier, moving toward fear is moving toward growth. And so let me get some last words from you, Jen. Like, how do you feel this conversation went? Do you think that the first episode was okay?
It was beautiful. No, it was beautiful, because I think that the all three of us hit very different experiences with fathers, because no father is perfect. No person is perfect. And I think that's hard for us to understand. For me, it was really hard, because I was like, the same. Like, why isn't my dad perfect? Like, why doesn't he do all the things the dads are supposed to do? And my dad is still alive. And so hearing the both of you makes me really think about it. Like, okay, no, what is my next move? And that's something that I do want to share, that, like, everyone's next move is different. I know for sure that my next move is, like, continue to heal, continue to process, but to let go of the mud.
Yes.
I don't want to carry the mud
down.
And I think that was that was a great crazy inner story, because it's been something that has been lingering for me. Even like talking about Father's Day, I've been processing, like, do I tell him Happy Father's Day? Do I not?
Yeah.
Well, I'm still mad. Well, what if he's going to think that I accept him? And it's like, I'm having all this back and forth with myself. And I think a lot of people do. And I want to normalize that, and that it's okay. But it's also okay to, after you process, after you feel the anger, the sadness, the resentment, all of the things, then that's when you can let go of your mud.
Yeah.
Because you really can't do that without feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because I also was a heavy drinker, I was like, well, if I just keep partying and drinking, like, eventually I'm not going to feel nothing. But I was really just numb for so long that now I'm 33 and I've been feeling so many emotions, and I'm like, yo, is this normal? Like,
yeah, because you're actually feeling for the first time.
And it is normal. It's normal to be sad. It's normal to cry. It's normal to be angry. And once you feel it, the thing is that you go through the tunnel and then you come out the other side.
There is another side. And the other side that you come out of is, you know, gratitude and, like, peace.
Yes.
Peace. And which is what I want for all of us.
And that's the only way to get the peace. It's the only way to get that tranquility that, like, today I was like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to say about my dad.
Yeah.
And just hearing you, I was like, oh, no, I have done the work.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it for me is, like, accepting, okay, I processed all the anger I had, and now I can see the light. Like, I can remember those good memories that I had forcefully, like, suppressed because I was like, well, he doesn't deserve Father's Day.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, okay, no, he did do these things, and, mm-hmm. and that those things were real.
Yeah, and you were that kind of, like, I saw that kind of spark for you when we were talking. Yeah. That's beautiful. I'm glad that you were here. Thank you guys for being here, both of you.
Thank you.
I think the way I'm going to end is the way I'm going to start with, which is with the Crazy Ernie story. So I'm going to let him go out, do his own outro, because this is the end of the conference that he was speaking at on recovery and staying clean. And like I said, he always taught through stories. And so this is the last story I'm going to share with you from Crazy Ernie on this episode. And thanks, Dad.
I hear people say, well, relapse is part of recovery. Fuck you. Fuck you. No, it's not. And you know, I watched this movie. You guys ever saw The Shawshank Redemption? Remember when Mr. Freeman tells that boy and tells him, get busy living or get busy dying. It's on.
Sorry about that. This is the wrong. There we go. Go.
Enough excuse to get loaded. I buried my mom on this program and two of my brothers. One died clean, one died loaded. And you know what? It didn't make any difference to me. I loved them the same. You know, I ain't got too much to say, man, but I'm going to tell you about my brother, Peter. He had 4 years clean when he passed away. And he went to a clinic in Mexico, right? Because he didn't want a liver. He just wanted to see if there was another way out. So he went to this clinic in Mexico, man. And the doctor goes, there's nothing we can do for you, man. You're going to die in about an hour, hour and a half tops, right? So, man, you know, I don't know about you, but I get angry. Well, really, the bottom line is I get fearful, man. Here, my dad would say, you take care of your brothers, man, no matter what the fuck. You know, no instructions, but take care of him. So I took a lot of punches for him, and I took a lot of beefs for him and all that shit. And here, man, I'm powerless. And I don't like being powerless. I don't know shit what the step says or anything else. I don't like being powerless. I like to be powerful. So he's dying, right? And the doctor tells the nurse, bring the tray. And they bring, like, a stainless steel tray. And there's fucking outfits. That shit look good to me, boy. Fucking outfits and pills and shit. And the doctor tells him, hey, Pete, you know, I know you're in pain, man. The blood coming out of his ears, his throat, and all that shit. And the doctor tells him, you want a shot of something? And he looks at me, and we used to go to the men's stag, you know, a lot on Wednesdays in East L.A. And And you know what my brother said? He said to tell you this. He said, hey, I'm not going to take anything. And he tells the doctor, I'm not going to take anything. He looks at me. He says, when you get back over there, man, tell the guys I didn't take nothing. Thank you.
It's the motherfucking Millennial Mija podcast.